we've been studying on Sunday mornings now is the book of James. James, that wrote this little epistle, please turn to the book there toward the end of your Bibles, is apparently the Lord's half-brother, born after Jesus to Mary and Joseph. And gets very much in your face, James does, here in chapter 4, starting in verse 1 particularly, and then well into chapter 5. Pointed this out last week, that this is the finger-wagging part of the book. This is where I'm talking to you, is what James is doing. And this man apparently lived all his days there in Jerusalem, had a prominent place of responsibility in Jerusalem in the early days of Christianity, and writes a book which now, as we've seen over the course of several months, is very picturesque, a lot of illustrations, very beautiful word pictures that he describes, illustrations that are given there, perhaps the most graphic of all the books, in fact, in the New Testament. But at this point, James is pretty unhappy with the behaviors of these Christians. And so we have seen last week that he points out the source, a wide range of problems, several sources, but that they've been having. And these sources are, number one, in chapter 4 and verse 1, their own desire for pleasure, for the satisfaction and gratification of the body. In verse 2, he talks about their lusts being at the root of all of these problems. Again, in verse 2, that envy is another driving force for the problems and conflicts that they have in their lives. And finally, in verse 4, that anyone tries to be a friend of the world makes themselves an enemy of God. So he's been very direct. You're guilty of quite a number of crimes, and they are not God's fault. You have these issues going on in your life, and they promote and provoke the various conflicts, confrontations, and problems that you've been having. So last week, particularly, you know, it's kind of an ugly session in the book, now which you'd really call very uplifting, not the kind of sermon material that makes you want to just run out, you know, with a smile on your face, you know, and take on life. Rather, it's an introspective kind of a thing. It is a reflective sort of section in the book. Am I guilty is what we should be asking ourselves. Pardon me for a second, my throat's rather raw. But that led us to chapter 4 and verse 5 last week, where we discover that we are made in the image of God. We are animated because His Spirit lives within us. You remove that Spirit, as God does for everyone eventually, and you are gone. And you are useless. You are inert. You are incapable ever again of changing your ways, of making a decision. It is only that the Spirit of God abides within us that any of these things are possible. And God, having given us a share of His own being, if you will, is jealous of what He has given us. He respects it. His Spirit, there's no darkness in it, no sin, no selfishness of any kind. That Spirit is utterly pure and righteous. And when we are born into this world, that's what we are as well. And then what do we do with it? We take this life, this decision-making ability that He has given us, and we surrender it to Satan, to his temptations, and to sin. We then, corrupt and pervert this perfect, pure thing that God has given us by the kinds of lives that we lead. So in verse 5, he says, do you think that the Scripture, and by this I don't mean an individual verse, I think he's referring to the entire Bible's teaching, speaks to no purpose. He jealously desires the Spirit which he has made to dwell in us. God wants that Spirit to remain pure. God hopes and expects that we forsake sin, that we will turn our backs on it, and that we will in no way, shape, or form pollute and corrupt that pure and righteous Spirit that he has given us. Now, the good news this morning, though, brethren, is that starting particularly in verse 6, James now is going to give us a list of solutions to our problems. We're not helpless and hopeless. This can be fixed. We have these lusts within us, that's true enough, but they are controllable. And if we would learn, now pardon me again, I'm just really struggling with my throat. I've got something caught in there. I can just feel it. It's on the left-hand side. It's like I inhaled what we used to call cockle burrs. You know, there's something just sticking in my craw. Yeah, it's not you. So I've got to give you just a second to see if I get that thing to move. I'm really feeling it. Okay. Let's see if we can get this going now. I've actually got a tear rolling down my left cheek here. All right, sermon, take three. James now is not only going to be giving us this list of solutions, if you will, things that we can do to correct these problems that we have created in ourselves, but there is one attitude that is very prominent in that section. So I'd like everybody, please, before I say much else, open up James 4, look at verse 6. We had a portion of it read already up through verse 17 earlier, a moment ago, thanks to Scott. And so look there and see if you can pick out a sort of a theme or an attitude that keeps cropping up. And I'd like to suggest, in fact, brethren, that it is the one thing that everything else which is said here in all those verses, 12 verses, is revolving really around one thing. And that thing is in verse 6. He, that is God, gives a greater grace. Therefore it says, God is opposed to the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Now, brethren, everything that follows in this sermon, I believe everything that follows in James' sermon, and all I'm doing is following James' sermon, is revolving around humility. And he is saying that all that has gone before with the problems you created, and all that follows in the entirety of chapter 4, has either your pride or your humility as its source. Let's take, for instance, these first things, brethren, the source of quarrels and conflicts among you. When you get involved with some sort of confrontation over anything with anybody, is that because you're so shy and retiring and yielding and just so humble that you would never dream of trying to impose your will on somebody else? When you have a conflict, brethren, what must you necessarily have? A very prominent sense of me. There's what I want. There's the territory that I've staked out, that I want to defend. There's the way I think that things should be. That is the only reason you could have a conflict. If you just instantly recognize the other person's ideas are better than yours, then that's the thing we ought to do, then where's the conflict? But it's because in your heart you have a sense of pride. You have a sense of confidence. You have this pride and this confidence to the exclusion and to the overriding of whoever else it is that you're talking to. And because you are demanding that that sense of pride, that sense of right and wrong be respected and maybe also even be implemented, you've got a conflict. Because they, of course, are standing over there in all abject humility. And all they want to do is give you what you want. Right? No, you're doing exactly the same thing you're doing. It's the way the world works. It's the way people, you know, commonly do. So that's what's gone before. But now look at verse 6 again. He gives greater grace. Therefore it says, God is opposed to the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. God is trying to bless us. God is trying to make our way easier. God is hoping that we'll be happy. He wants to extend something to us that we really don't deserve. His grace. He's trying to help us. He's offering this to us. Now watch what happens in verse 7. Submit, therefore, to God, and He will draw near to you. Submit, therefore, to God. Resist the devil, it is actually in verse 7, and he will flee from you. Brethren, what is the source of all submission? It is a sense of humility. Not my way or the highway, your way. So, I will lay aside what I think is best. I will forsake what I think ought to be done. I will accept, I will submit, I will yield to your view. This grace that God gives us is revealed in Scripture, as well as being shared, of course, in His heart and mine. But if we will submit to what God has told us to do, brethren, then, verse 7, consequently, and as well, resist the devil. What does the devil do? He is forced to flee from us. Because all too often, we can't find the humility to submit to God's will and to God's way. And we camp out, you know, on our own thoughts, our own sense of wisdom, you know, our own intelligence and ideas, and now we're trying to do things our way instead of God's way. We are not submitting to Him. And then that's the case, and you have that corollary there in verse 7, brethren, it is necessarily so. If I won't submit to God, then what is the devil doing? He's not fleeing. The devil draws nearer. Satan has more power and influence in my life, which brings us to verse 8 now. Draw near to God, He'll draw near to you. But you draw near to God by submitting to His will, in which case Satan will flee. If I'm not drawing near to God, if I'm not submitting, if I can't find the humility to do that, then Satan becomes the most prominent influence in my life. He not only does not flee, but God Himself is drawing away from me. That's what I mean when I say this is kind of scary material that James is presenting right here. And then, to emphasize, we'll say graphically again, how we ought to be behaving, he says, cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be miserable and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned into mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and He will exalt you. He'll lift you up. He'll honor you. He clears the way for you. Things will be so much better. Now, brethren, when I'm looking at James, admonitions to saints who were scattered across the Roman Empire in a wide variety of cities and circumstances, the same truth will work for everyone wherever they are. If you draw near to God, God draws near to you. If you submit to Him, Satan flees from you. And the humility that he has first mentioned in verse 6, that is the reason why he gives grace, is now brought to the fore, yet again in verse 10, as an absolute command. Humble yourselves in the presence of the Lord, and He will exalt you. Your way will be easier when you humble yourself in the sight of your God, when you submit to His will. Now we're thinking, well, okay, you know, I get that, and that's not such a hard concept. It's not like we all, haven't read this before. By the way, there won't be any more slides. Maybe I'll just take that off the screen there. But we're just doing, a Bible study here this morning. This humility is the answer to all of their conflicts and problems. It is the source of God's grace for them in the midst of all kinds of difficulties. So, humble yourself, verse 10, in the presence of the Lord. He'll exalt you. And then watch what happens next. Do not speak against one another, brethren. He who speaks against a brother or judges his brother speaks against the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you're not a doer of the law, but a judge of it. There's only one lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and destroy. But who are you? Who judge your neighbor? Now stop right there, brethren. That expression is familiar to us today as it was to these Christians 2,000 years ago. Whenever anybody says to you, who are you? The more common form perhaps in America today is, who do you think you are? Have they unleashed those words upon you because they're so moved by your humility? Has anybody ever said, whoa, I wish I could be as humble as you. Who are you? They don't do that, do they? Brothers, this is 2,000 years of using an expression that everybody understands is a rhetorical, format that is also pointing the finger and saying, your problem is a lack of humility. Your problem is thinking too highly of yourself. You, when you speak against your brethren, set yourself above them. But what James now points out, what must have been a stunning surprise, I think, for them, as it is for us today, I hope, is that when you are doing that, you are speaking against the law in verse 10, you are judging the law, and you are demonstrating that you are not a doer of that law, but a judge, and you are doing this in the place of the only lawgiver and judge, the one who is able to save and to destroy. Who are you to ever judge a neighbor? Brethren, all of that is either humility-based or lack of humility-based. That theme is ever-present. Look in verse 13. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we shall go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you don't know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are a vapor. It appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we shall live and also do this or that. Now watch in verse 16. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is, and as you look at the last word in verse 16, let me just put the opposite of humility. All boasting is forever and will always be the opposite of humility. When you boast, your problem is arrogance. Your problem is conceit. Your problem is an absolute absence of humility. Humility, brethren, I overlooked, I think, for quite a few years, is the foundation for all things in the fourth chapter of the book of James. And it is not absent in the 17th verse. A big problem we have as Christians, I've had it all my life, I'll have it to the end of my days, I suppose, is taking a passage out of context. We find a phrase or an expression that's memorable. We find a phrase or expression that is powerful. We find a phrase or expression that is very common in our culture. Everybody uses it all the time. We have expressions, then, that wind up standing alone and detached from the source that they were lifted out of. Big problem here. So how many times have you heard, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin? There's not a person in this room, I guess, that isn't familiar with that expression. But do you usually quote that with the first word you see in verse 17? And I'm thinking the answer is almost never. We don't say, therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. We don't look back at all the verses that have preceded. We don't get the big picture there of what James has been talking about through 16 verses before we say, to him who knows to do right and doesn't do it, to him it is a sin. And what have we done? We have stripped, brethren, our understanding, a proper understanding of verse 17, completely out of the words. We have lost the foundation and platform that whole expression was built on. That expression
is built on humility. So after he has mentioned the word humble several times, after he has ordered it in verse 10, humble yourselves, after he has criticized the opposite of humility, which is the arrogance of thinking that you control anything and that you're going to do this or that tomorrow. I've been whining, I guess, you know, on Wednesday night about the week I had. You know, we had a couple of good rain-free days, and I thought, well, I'll get a little bit of work done outside. You know, I've got some yard work needs to be done before the weather caves in. So I had these plans about, you know, what I was going to do in the few hours we had of sunshine, you know, in the course of this last week. And then my brother called, and his renter wants to redo the entire contract. And before it was over, we had lost not only the renter, but the woman who was taking care of my mom's medical needs and doing some light house cleaning. So these two had been working together and got angry, you know, and the next thing we knew, the renter leaves, and we're also looking for a caregiver for my mom. So, while the sun was shining, what was I doing this week? Talking to my brother down in Southern California about problems that he and I share because of my mom's involvement, you know, down there in a property I haven't seen in 2 years, where my mom lives. So, what happened to all my plans? Vapor in the wind, right? Just like me. Okay? Just like me.
Now, if I get that I am not in control, if I get God's will be done, and that means everybody else's needs come before mine, what is the royal law? Chapter 2, of your neighbor. So if I get that, then, brethren, will I always do the right thing. If God's will is first and your needs trump mine, will I be humble? Yes. So while I'm kicking around and lamenting this problem, I do love my mom. My brother needed some help down there and all the difficulties that were going on. And what about the sunshine? He'll be back, we think. Come spring. Brethren, now watch. Verse 16, as it is, you boast in your arrogance. Anytime you have plans like that, where you just think it's going to go my way, all such boasting is evil. And since it is the antithesis of humility, therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is a sin, brethren. Why? Because if you know the right thing to do and you don't do it, that is the height of arrogance. That is a judgment on the law and the lawgiver. If you know what the right thing is to do, then you know what God's will is. And if you don't do it, that you have set yourself as a judge over God's will and decided that you will not do it. That is mighty serious business, isn't it? And it is an act of just consummate conceit. Now, rather, if you weave all the first 16 verses into verse 17, you will see. He's not just talking about doctrinal issues and whether or not you can use instrumental music and, you know, this kind of stuff, as important as those things are. He's talking about the attitude with which you confront your every decision at every moment in every day. And if you will start and continue and end with humility, then whenever you see the right thing to do, you will submit to God. He'll draw nearer to you and Satan will flee because you have been able to control yourself to recognize, I'm just a vapor. What would God have me do here? Oh, I see the right thing to do. And if I don't, then it is evil and it is sin. And it's because I lack
Humility.
Now I'm going to close serendipitously with Luke chapter 14. I had not intended to tie these two lessons together, but it's the material that we came to and finished with this morning in the class with the teens and young adults. And so I'm just going to be fair and impartial, because we read something about impartiality in chapter 2 also, didn't we? So what I'm going to do with you now, all you adults and parents, what I did with the teens this morning. I want you to think about knowing the right thing to do and then not doing it in the context of Luke chapter 14. Now that you're there, look at, I'm going to find this now, verse 12. Luke 14, 12. Jesus went on to say to the one who had invited him, "When you give a luncheon or a dinner, do not invite your friends or your brothers or your relatives or rich neighbors, lest they also invite you in return and repayment come to you. But when you give a reception, invite the poor, the crippled, the lame, and the blind. Bearing in mind from verse 12, brethren, that you don't know these people. They're not friends and they're not family." So I asked my teens, when was the last time you saw anybody you know ever do that right thing that Jesus commanded? Have you ever seen it happen? We all raised our hands and agree that we never have. I won't ask for short hands. Brethren, what did Jesus say? Who should we be inviting? Who is it that we're trying to seek to get to know and to help? All the members of the church here that we know and love so much? Or those strangers out there in that world who have all kinds of problems and needs to which we hold the solutions, but lacking the humility to put their needs above ours, what have we become? Safely cloistered, you know, and working with ourselves. Now, brother, there's more of that story to understand. But I'm saying, humility causes me to obey God's commandments, every one. And when I submit to them, he draws near to me and Satan flees. And then I see the right thing to do, and I do it. Now, I'm ashamed to say, I believe that there must be dozens and maybe hundreds of similar teachings like Luke 14, 12, and 13 there that I've just never really got to understand and to apply like I should. If you know to do right, brethren, do it. And what will be the driving force behind your successfully submitting to the will of God? The humility to realize that you don't matter, you have no control, you don't even know what's going to happen tomorrow. But there's an eternity waiting for all of us if we draw near to God, submit to His will, control ourselves in humility, and do what is right. Remember James? Yeah, his pointed finger. We've got the same problems they've got, brethren. Let's use the same solutions. So, again, not the most uplifting material you've ever heard. James is kind of harsher. Blame it on him. So let's get the message. And we can help you now in Bible study and prayer in some other way. You know, if we can be an encouragement to you, by all means, let me know. But if you're ready to be baptized into Christ this very morning, please, today be the day of salvation. Come forward and speak with me as we stand and sing.